You're listening to the Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network.
In the future, none of you are heroes.
You're legends.
Get driven. Stay driven.
Guys, today we're going to talk about some people that fell down and never got back up. We're talking about the Heaven's Gate Cold. Now, before we begin, I want to say there's always a call-in number. You guys can call in and converse with me anytime you like. Call-in number is 718-508-9883. Welcome back to the Bareback Facts, guys. Hope you're ready. We're doing a little segments here, cult history. We did Jim Jones and Jonestown. Things got a little intense in here, and things are going to get a little weird in here today. So we're talking about a very odd cult, one that is really, really out there. And by out there, I mean look to the stars, baby. Marshall Applewhite's cult, the Heaven's Gate cult, notably called and probably aptly nicknamed the UFO cult. So let's get into it. Let's talk a little bit about Marshall Applewhite and Heaven's Gate. We'll talk a little bit about the background of Marshall and what's the deal with this. So Marshall Herf Applewhite Jr. was born May 17th, 1931. And, of course, like so many of his followers, he's going to meet his end on March 26th, 1997. Not a guy that believed in waiting around too long to get things knocked out. He went by a number of different monikers, ranging from Doe, Bo, Tiddly, Ningen, and Guinea. He is known for being the founder of Heaven's Gate. He's a native Texan, so Texans get another one. You guys get one. I think every state gets at least one psycho, but here we go. Applewhite attended numerous universities as a young man. He served in the United States Army. Now, after finishing school at Austin College, he taught music at the University of Alabama and later returned to Texas, where he led choruses and served as the chair of the music department at the University of St. Thomas in Houston. This is a man that had a very interesting life, to say the least. He was born in Spur, Texas, a little bitty town, and his wife, Louise, well, I should say his mother, Louise, and his father, Marshall Herf Applewhite Sr., probably never really saw this coming on the horizon, but there was quite a bit coming. He had three siblings, and was son of a Presbyterian minister. He became very, very religious as a child. He attended Corpus Christi High School and, as I said, Austin College, latter school. Once he got to college, he was incredibly active in several student organizations and was moderately religious. He earned a bachelor's degree in philosophy in 1952 and subsequently enrolled at Union Presbyterian Seminary to study theology, hoping to become a minister. He would later marry Ann Pierce around that time, and they later had two children. Now, early in his seminary studies, he decided to leave the school to pursue a career in music, becoming the music director of a Presbyterian church in North Carolina. He was a baritone singer and enjoyed spirituals and the music of Handel. So at least he had good taste in music. In 1954, of course, I mentioned he served in the military. He was drafted by the United States Army, and he served in Austria and New Mexico as a member of the Army Signal Corps. He left the military in 1956 and enrolled at the University of Colorado, where he earned a master's degree in music and focused on musical theater. So a creative individual, to say it the very least. He would later move to New York City, and in an unsuccessful attempt to launch a professional singing career upon finishing his education in Colorado, he then taught at the University of Alabama, where he lost his position there after pursuing a sexual relationship with a male student, which was not reciprocated. His religious education was likely not supportive of same-sex relationships, and he was subsequently frustrated by his sexual desires. He separated from his wife when she learned of the affair in 1965, and they divorced 3 years later. After leaving the University of Alabama, Applewhite moved to Houston, Texas. And in 1965, he started teaching at the University of St. Thomas. His students regarded him as an engaging speaker and a very stylish dresser. He served as chair of the music department. He also became a locally popular singer, serving as the chorale director of an Episcopal church and performing with the Houston Grand Opera. So a guy that really, really did have some promise. In Texas, he was briefly openly gay, but also pursued a relationship with a young woman who left him under pressure from her family, which greatly upset him. He resigned from the University of St. Thomas in 1970, citing depression and other emotional problems. Robert Balsh and David Taylor, sociologists who studied Applewhite's group following their demise, speculate that this departure was prompted by another affair between Applewhite and a student. The president of the university later recalled that he was often mentally jumbled and disorganized near the end of his employment. In 1971, Applewhite would briefly move to New Mexico, where he operated a delicatessen. He was popular with customers, but decided to return to Texas later that year. His father would die around that time, and the loss took a significant emotional toll on him, causing him to once again slip into a severe depression. His debts began to mount, forcing him to borrow money from friends. Now, in 1972, Applewhite would meet Bonnie Nettles, a nurse with an interest in theosophy and biblical prophecy. The two quickly became close friends. He later recalled that he felt like he'd known her for a long time and concluded that they had met in a past life. Now, before we continue talking about Nettles and Applewhite and their early travels and their establishment of the cult, let's take a look at Nettles' life as well, because she is an integral part of this cult's foundation. She is the yin to his yang. She is the peanut butter to Applewhite's jelly, and we're going to get into her as well. Bonnie Lou Nettles was born August 29, 1927, and died around June 19, 1985, later known as T, and was a co-leader of a group with Marshall Applewhite that later became the Heaven's Gate cult. She died of liver cancer in Dallas, Texas in 1985. 12 years before the group's mass suicide in March 1997. We'll talk a little bit about that and how it impacted the cult as well. She went by a variety of names. T was one of them. She also went by Peep, Wink, Pig, Poop, Shelly West, Heavens, Goat, or G-O-A-T. There you go. She was born and raised in Houston into a Baptist family, and as an adult, she moved away from the religion. After becoming a registered nurse, she married a businessman by the name of Joseph Segal Nettles, not to be confused with Stephen Segal, Joseph Segal Nettles, in December of 1949, with whom she had four children. Their marriage remained mostly stable until 1972, and according to the New York Times, their marriage began to deteriorate due to Nettles' belief. A 19th century monk named Brother Francis frequently spoke with her and gave her instructions. Furthermore, Nettles often conducted seances with mediums in order to contact other deceased spirits. A circle group was held every Wednesday at her house in relation to this. She also studied astrology, theosophy, and occult studies, and in 1972 went to see multiple fortune tellers who told her that she was soon to meet a mysterious man who was tall with light hair and a fair complexion. And the description ended up being fairly close to Applewhite's appearance. Now let's return to this fortuitous meeting between Applewhite and Nettles. And as I mentioned, they met in 1972, and they quickly become close friends. Now Applewhite, as I mentioned, said that he felt like he'd known her for a long time and concluded that they had met in a past life. She told him their meeting had been foretold to her by extraterrestrials, or fortune tellers in this case, persuading him that he had a divine assignment. By that time, he had begun to investigate alternatives to traditional Christian doctrine, including, but not limited to, astrology and the occult. He also had several visions, including one in which he was told that he was chosen for a role like that of Jesus. And in her 2005 profile of Applewhite, Susan Rain speculated that he had a schizophrenic episode around this time. Would not be surprised by that at all, considering the mental strain that Applewhite had and his own personal personality crisis that he was having, particularly in relation to his questions about the morality versus his desire for sexual intercourse with people of the same sex. So, you know, it's a complicated thing for him. Plus, you know, dealing with the grief of his father. But who knew that grief could take him this far? Applewhite soon began to live with Nettles. Although they cohabited, their relationship was not a sexual one, fulfilling his longtime wish to have a deep and loving yet platonic relationship. She was married with two children, but after she became close with Applewhite, her husband divorced her, and she lost custody of the children. Applewhite permanently broke off contact with his family as well, and saw Nettles as, and some of his acquaintances later recalled that she had a strong influence on him. Rain writes that Nettles was responsible for reinforcing his emerging delusional beliefs, but another psychiatrist by the name of Robert J. Lipton speculates that Nettles' influence helped him avoid further psychological deterioration. Applewhite and Nettles opened a bookstore known as the Christian Art Center, which carried books from a variety of spiritual backgrounds. They also launched a venture known as No Place to teach classes on mysticism and theosophy. They closed these businesses a short time later, however, and in February of 1973, they resolved to travel to teach others about their beliefs and drove throughout the Southwest and Western United States. Lipton described their travels as a restless, intense, often confused, and peripatetic spiritual journey. While traveling, they had little money and occasionally resorted to selling their blood or working odd jobs for much-needed funds. Listen, guys, if you got to get to the point where you're selling your blood, you probably just need to stop what you're doing. This message is probably not that important. They subsisted solely on bread rolls at times, often camped out, and sometimes they did not pay their lodging bills. Surprise, surprise. One of their friends from Houston corresponded with them and agreed to accept their teachings. They visited her in May of 1974, and she became their first convert. Traveling, Applewhite and Nettles pondered the life of St. Francis of Assisi and read works by authors including Helena Blavatsky, R.D. Lang, and Richard Bach. They kept a King James version of the Bible with them and studied several passages from the New Testament, focusing on teachings about Christology, aestheticism, and eschatology. Now, if you're not familiar with what these things are, let me give you the basic preface on what these things are. Christian eschatology, sorry guys, eschatology, is a major branch of study within Christian theology, and it deals with the last thing. It comes from the Greek words meaning last, eschatos, and oriai, study. So it is the study of end things. So the study of whether the end of an individual life, the end of the age, the end of the world, the nature of the kingdom of God. Broadly speaking, it's the study concerned with the ultimate destiny of the individual soul and the entire created order based primarily upon biblical texts within the Old and New Testament. So it studies matters such as death and the afterlife, heaven and hell, the second coming of Christ, the resurrection of the dead, the rapture, the tribulation, millennialism, the end of the world, the last judgment, the new heaven, new earth, and the world to come. Basically, it's all revelation. It's all the study of revelation. It's the study of the end times. And then you get aestheticism, which is from sensual pleasures. And this does not necessarily mean specifically, you know, sex. It also refers to living very lean lifestyle, so not having luxuries, essentially. Living a very pious, humble life where you don't have a lot. You live off as little as possible. And this is something that early monks, particularly in the Middle Ages, were well known for doing. There were many ascetic monk groups and even ascetic nuns who basically just left everything they owned, left everybody that they knew, went off into the wilderness and just fasted and prayed and got really close to God, supposedly, according to them. Now, so that gives you guys some ideas about what asceticism and eschatology are. Now, Applewhite also read science fiction, including works by Robert A. Heinlein and Arthur C. Clarke. And by June of 1974, Applewhite and Nettles' beliefs had solidified into a basic outline. They concluded that they had been chosen to fulfill prophecies and that they had been given higher-level minds than other people. They wrote a pamphlet that described Jesus' reincarnation as a Texan, a thinly veiled reference to Applewhite. Furthermore, they concluded that they were the two witnesses described in the Book of Revelation and occasionally visited church or other spiritual groups to speak of their identities, often referring to themselves as the two, or the UFO two. They believed that they would be killed and then restored to life in view of others, transported onto a spaceship. This event, which they referred to as the demonstration, was to prove their claims. To their dismay, these ideas were pretty poorly received. As you can well imagine, when you're going around telling people who already have their beliefs, you know, hey, by the way, I'm right. You know, I'm the chosen of God. And by the way, I'm going to get sucked up in a spaceship. And yeah, you know, a lot of people are not going to take that kind of, what would we call that, bullshit very well. That, you know, when you go, you know, it's about like, you know, going to somebody's house and taking a giant crap on their front porch. They're probably not going to be too happy about it, which is precisely what they did to multiple religious communities. They essentially showed up, took a giant shit on everything that they believed in, and then left after people were kind of like, huh, these guys are probably a little off their hinges. But guys, I'm going to tell you right now, the rabbit hole gets a hell of a lot deeper than this. So things began to escalate a little bit quickly with this group in August of 19 in Harlingen, Texas, for failing to return a car that he rented in Missouri. He was then extradited to St. Louis and jailed for 6 months. At the time, he maintained that he'd been divinely authorized to keep the car. Yeah, we saw how that didn't work out. While jailed, he pondered theology and subsequently abandoned discussion of occult topics in favor of extraterrestrials and evolution. After Applewhite's release, he and Nettles resolved to contact extraterrestrials, and they sought like-minded followers. They published advertisements for meetings where they recruited disciples who they called the crew. At the events, they purported to represent beings from another planet, the next level, who sought participants for an experiment. They claimed that those who had agreed to take part in the experiment would be brought to a higher evolutionary level. He and Nettles referred to themselves as Guinea and Pig, respectively. Applewhite described his role as a lab instructor and served as the primary speaker, while Nettles occasionally interjected clarifying remarks or corrections. The two seldom personally spoke with attendees, only taking phone numbers with which they could contact them. They initially named their organization the Anonymous Sexaholic Celibate Church, but it soon became known as the Human Individual Metamorphosis. Even more of a mouthful than Anonymous Sexaholics Celibate Church, which sounds like a very boring place to hang out. But I digress. Believed in the ancient astronaut hypothesis, one that we see always posited on the popular show Ancient Aliens. So who knew that bullshit could create more bullshit? Oh, I could have told you that, but here we go. Down the rabbit hole, Applewhite went, which claimed, according to the ancient astronaut hypothesis, for those of you who have not watched Ancient Aliens and poisoned your brain, they claim, this hypothesis claimed that extraterrestrials had visited humanity in the past and placed humans on Earth and would return to collect a select few. And for whatever reason, parts of the hypothesis assume that, you know, aliens have had contact with us in the past, and they probably still do every once in a while. And for whatever reason, they decided to propel the human race forward in various ways, whether that be giving us technology, intervening on our behalf, or their own agenda, their own purpose. Nobody knows. But according to the theory, aliens are real, and they've been interfering with humans for generations and generations, for centuries, basically. Since time immemorial. Sorry, guys. Little cheesiness had to get in there. Now, parts of this teaching bear similarities to the Reformed Christian conception, likely owing to Applewhite's Presbyterian upbringing. He often discussed extraterrestrials using phrases from Star Trek and stated that aliens communicated with him through the show. So if that wasn't a red flag for the rest of the assholes that were following him around, you know, I don't know what was. Apparently nothing. Applewhite and Nettles sent advertisements to groups in California and were invited to speak to New Age devotees there in April of 1975. Now, at this meeting, they persuaded about half of the 50 attendees to follow them. They also focused on college campuses, speaking at Canada College in August, at a meeting in Oregon in September 1975. They saw further recruitment success. About 30 people left their homes to follow the pair, prompting interest from media outlets. The coverage was predominantly negative, as well it might be, because you got a couple of nut jobs running around convincing people to just follow them blindly. Commentators and some former members mocked the group and leveled accusations of brainwashing against Applewhite and Nettles. Balch and Taylor state that Applewhite and Nettles eschewed pressure tactics, seeking only devoted followers. So they didn't want to be challenged at all. So they pretty much took the lower intelligence people that they could get. Now, Benjamin E. Zeller, who is an academic that studies new religions, notes that Applewhite and Nettles' teachings focused on salvation through individual growth and sees this as similar to the currents in the era's New Age movement. Likewise, the importance of personal choice was emphasized. Applewhite and Nettles denied connection with the New Age movement as a human creation. One sociologist by the name of Janja Lalish, who studies cults, attributes their recruitment success to their eclectic mix of the beliefs and the way that they deviate from typical New Age teachings, discussing literal spaceships while retaining familiar language. Most of their disciples were young and interested in occultism or otherwise lived outside of mainstream society. They came from a variety of religious backgrounds, including Eastern religions and Scientology. Most were well-versed in the New Age teachings, allowing Applewhite and Nettles to convert them quite easily. Applewhite thought that his followers would reach a higher level of being, changing like a caterpillar, becoming a butterfly. This example was used in almost all of their early literature. Applewhite contended that this would be a biological change into a different species, casting his teachings as scientific truth and aligned with secular naturalism. He emphasized to his early followers that he was not speaking metaphorically, often using the words biology and chemistry in his statements. By the mid-1970s, he attempted to avoid the use of the term religion altogether, seeing it as inferior to science in every way. Although he dismissed religion as unscientific, he sometimes emphasized the need for faith in the aliens' abilities to transform them. Now, by 1975, Applewhite and Nettles had taken the names of Bo and Beep. What a pair these guys are. Aren't they fun? They had about 70 followers at this time and saw themselves as shepherds tending a flock. Applewhite believed that complete separation from earthly desires was a prerequisite of ascension to the next level and emphasized passages in the New Testament in which Jesus spoke about forsaking worldly attachments. Members were consequently instructed to renounce friends, family, media, drugs, alcohol, jewelry, facial hair, and, of course, sexuality, because in life you can't have anything good. Friends, family, media, drugs, alcohol, jewelry, facial hair, and sexuality, that's a lot to give up. Listen, I don't like to go without shaving for a while when I can help it, but having the option to grow out a beard is pretty nice. But, I mean, alcohol, sex, friends and family. I mean, that's like four really awesome things right there that I am not willing to give up on. So I'm going to have to pass on those things. Oh, I'm giving those up. But, you know, apparently some other people thought, hey, hell of a trade, let's do this. Furthermore, they were required to adopt biblical names. Now, Applewhite and Nettles soon told them to adopt two-syllable names that ended in O-D. And had three consonants in the first syllable, such as Ricodi and Jimodi and Livodi. Applewhite stated that these names emphasized that his followers were spiritual children. Applewhite, Nettles, and their followers lived what religious scholar James Lewis described as a quasi-nomadic lifestyle. They usually stayed at remote campgrounds and didn't speak about their beliefs. Applewhite and Nettles later ceased having public meetings in 1975 and spent little time teaching doctrine to their converts. The leaders also had little contact with their dispersed followers, many of whom renounced their allegiance at this time because, to hell, you're not teaching me anything. I guess, we're not a part of this. Now, by 1975, Applewhite and Nettles start getting even, and I can't believe I'm saying that, this right now because we who would have thought this crap was possible, but they start getting even more crazy. They start really taking off. Applewhite and Nettles begin to fear that they're going to be assassinated and taught their followers that their deaths would be similar to those of the two witnesses of the book of Revelation. It's believed that Applewhite's prison experience and early rejection by audiences contributed to his fear. Applewhite and Nettles later explained to their followers that the former's treatment by the press was a form of assassination and had fulfilled their prophecy. Applewhite took a very materialistic view of the Bible, seeing it as a record of extraterrestrial contact with humanity. He drew heavily from the book of Revelation, although he avoided traditional theological terminology and took a somewhat negative tone towards Christianity. He only lectured about a small number of verses, and he never tried to develop a system of theology in regards to what he was teaching. By early 1976, Applewhite and Nettles had settled on the names Doe in this scenario, and T. Do, re, mi, fa, sol, la, ti, and, you know the rest, guys. Applewhite stated that these were meaningless names. In June 1976, they gathered their remaining followers at Medicine Bow National Forest in southeastern Wyoming, promising a UFO visit. Nettles later announced that the visit had been canceled. Applewhite and Nettles then split their followers into small groups, which they referred to as star clusters. Ooh, we're going to be a star cluster, guys. Star clusters for everybody. From 1976 to 1979, the group lived in campgrounds, usually in the Rocky Mountains or Texas. And during this time, Applewhite and Nettles began to place greater demands on their followers, heretofore loosely structured lives, which improved membership retention. And they typically communicated with their disciples in writing or through assistants, and increasingly they emphasized that they were the only source of truth. The idea that members could receive individual revelations was rejected in an attempt to prevent schisms. Ah, you got to prevent those schisms. We don't want other people thinking for themselves. Just let me do the thinking for you, okay? We got all the ideas. Just trust us on this. Applewhite and Nettles, we would never leave you wrong. We'd never lead you astray here. Applewhite also sought to prevent close friendships amongst his followers, fearing that this could lead to insubordination. Nettles and Applewhite insisted that their followers practice what they referred to as flexibility, strict obedience to their often shifting requests. The two leaders limited the group's contacts, those outside the movement, even some who may have been interested in joining, ostensibly to prevent infiltration from hostile parties. In practice, this made their followers completely dependent on them. They couldn't seek outside of the group. Now, Applewhite instructed his disciples to be like children or pets in their submission. Their sole responsibility was to obey the leaders. Members were encouraged to constantly seek Applewhite's advice and often ask themselves what their leaders would do when making a decision. What would Applewhite do? What would Doe do in this situation? What would he do? Will I have the turkey or will I have the ham? No, I will ask Applewhite what he would do, and he would say chicken salad. Applewhite instructed his disciples to do this, and they did. To his followers, he did not seem dictatorial, despite the fact that he was, in fact, and many of them found him laid back and fatherly. In his year 2000 study of the group, Winston Davis stated that Applewhite mastered the fine art of religious entertainment, noting that many of his disciples seemed to enjoy their service. Applewhite would organize seemingly arbitrary rituals that were intended to instill a sense of discipline in his followers. He referred to these tasks as games. He also watched science fiction television programs with the rest of the group, and rather than issue direct commands, he attempted to express his preferences and nominally offer his disciples a choice. He emphasized that the students were free to disobey if they chose. Something we refer to as the illusion of choice. Because obviously, now that we're here and we've had this sense of loyalty and obedience instilled in us this entire time, we're obviously not going to choose to disobey because we're in now, baby, and we're not leaving. No, we're in heaven's gate now. We're not leaving. So we're going to definitely do whatever this guy says. Plus, I mean, come on. What could possibly go wrong? Now, in the 1970s, the group received a large sum of money, possibly an inheritance of a member or donations of followers' income, but it was used to rent houses, initially in Denver and later in Dallas. Applewhite and Nettles at this time had about 40 followers then and lived in two or three houses. The leaders usually had their own house. The group was secretive about their lifestyle, covering their windows. Applewhite and Nettles arranged their followers' lifestyles as a boot camp that would prepare them for the next level. Ooh, the next level. Referring to their house as a craft, they regimented the lives of their disciples to the very minute. Students who were not committed to this lifestyle were encouraged to leave. Departing members were given financial assistance. So that's nice, right? Applewhite wanted quality over quantity in his followers. Although occasionally he spoke about gaining many converts, he preferred that he could have as much control over these converts as possible. And smaller group meant that he could exert his influence over these people a lot more easily without chances of dissent. Now, Applewhite and Nettles made sudden drastic changes to the group. On one occasion in Texas, they told their followers of a forthcoming visitation from extraterrestrials and instructed them to wait outside all night, at which point they informed them that this had merely been a test. This was a way that in which they increased their students' devotion, ensuring that their commitment became irrespective of what they saw. So it didn't matter anymore whether or not we see these spaceships that we're being told are coming. At this point, we're being told over and over again we're being tested. So we're sticking with it, guys. I mean, these people would never lie to me, right? I mean, obviously not. I mean, obviously they're smart enough. They got to know something. Talking about a next level. Guys, I want to be next level. We all do. So in 1980, Applewhite and Nettles had about 80 followers at this point. And these guys, they wanted to be next level. These people really wanted it. Many of them held jobs and often worked with computers or as car mechanics, so you know, they were handy. And in 1982, Applewhite and Nettles allowed their disciples to call their family. They further relaxed their control in 1983, permitting their followers to visit relatives on Mother's Day. Now, they were only allowed short stays and were instructed to tell their families that they were studying computers at a monastery. These vacations were intended to placate families by demonstrating that the disciples remained with the group of their own accord. So the objective at this point, in the case of Heaven's Gate, outside pressures are starting to get Applewhite and Nettles. People are getting suspicious. They're accusing Applewhite of being a cult leader, and you know, you just can't have that. You know, obviously he is a cult leader, but you know, you don't want people calling you that. I mean, how could they say it out loud? I mean, how dare they tell it how it is? You got to hate it when they tell it how it is, right? Unfortunately, in 1983, Nettles had an eye surgically removed as a result of cancer diagnosed several years earlier. She would live for two more years, and eventually, in 1985, she would pass away due to complications from cancer. Applewhite told their followers that she had traveled to the next level because she had too much energy to remain on Earth, abandoning her body to make the journey. His attempt to explain her death in the terms of the group's doctrine was successful, preventing the departure of all but one member. After Nettles died and Applewhite lost his soulmate was gone, he became very depressed. He claimed that Nettles still communicated with him, but he suffered from a crisis of faith. His students supported him during this time, greatly encouraging him. He then organized a ceremony in which he symbolically married his followers. Now, critics and scholars of New Age religion and cult history will tell us that this was an attempt to ensure unity and to ensure his control over these people. Maybe Applewhite was just a little odd, and this was just yet another way in which not only he could maintain his control, but when another way that he could reach the next level of freaking crazy. So, you know, it's a going trend. This guy is just constantly topping himself. Now, Applewhite told his followers that he had been left behind by Nettles because he still had more to learn. He felt that she occupied a higher spiritual role than he did. And he began identifying her as the father and often referred to her with male pronouns. He began to emphasize a strict hierarchy, teaching that his students needed his guidance, as he needed guidance of the next level. Naturally, this ensured that there'd be no possibility of the group's continuing if Applewhite were to die. A relationship with Applewhite was said to be the only way to salvation. How convenient. He encouraged his followers to see him as a living Christ. Scholars indicate that the group's previous focus on individual choice was replaced with an emphasis on Applewhite's role as a mediator. He maintained some aspects of their scientific teachings, but in the 80s, Applewhite steered the group into a different direction. The group became more like a religion in its focus on faith and submission to Applewhite's authority. After Applewhite Nettles' death, Applewhite himself also altered his own view of ascension. Previously, he had taught the group would physically ascend from the earth, and that death caused reincarnation. But her death, which left behind an unchanged corporeal body, forced him to say that the ascension could be spiritual. He then concluded that her spirit had traveled to a spaceship and received a new body, and that he and his followers would do the same. In his view, the biblical heaven was actually a planet on which highly evolved beings dwelt, and physical bodies were required to ascend there. Applewhite believed that once they reached the next level, they would facilitate evolution on other planets. He emphasized that Jesus, whom he believed was an extraterrestrial, came to Earth, was killed, and bodily rose from the dead before being transported onto a spaceship. According to Applewhite's doctrine, Jesus was a gateway to heaven, but had found humanity unready to ascend when he first came to the planet. Applewhite then decided that there was an opportunity for humans to reach the next level every two millennia. Oh. And during the early 1990s would therefore provide the first opportunity to reach the kingdom of heaven since the time of Christ. Zeller, one such scholar who's very well known for critiquing this individual and his cult, in his book, here we go. Where did it go? Oh, hang on, guys. Benjamin Zeller, sorry, guys. Extraterrestrial Biblical Hermeneutics and the Making of Heaven's Gate. So that's his book, in case you guys want to look at it. It's from the University of California in Berkeley Press. So you guys will want to take a look at that if you get the opportunity. I like to give you guys that source material. You know, nothing like some tasty source material. But I digress. Let's return to the matter of hand. And that matter at hand is what Applewhite had decided. Applewhite decided that he would be the one to provide the first opportunity to reach the kingdom of heaven since the time of Christ. And in the writings of Zeller, he notes that these beliefs were based on the Christian Bible, but were interpreted through the lens of belief in alien contact with humanity. So there's a mismatch of science fiction, this ancient astronaut hypothesis and theory, and Marshall Applewhite's own unique nuttiness, all coalescing together in one big, nasty bin of poisoned grape Kool-Aid that we'll get into a little bit later. But before we get into what Applewhite developed as his new doctrine and where it leads the rest of his group, we're going to take a short commercial break. And it's at this time, guys, that I want to remind you we do have a proud new sponsor here at Totally Driven Entertainment. He's funny, he's wacky, and he's crazy. Check out ChrisFraleyPresents.com for some lighter, more humorous material than what I'm covering today, perhaps. But you guys, nonetheless, will want to check that out. When we return, we're going to get into the change in Heaven's Gate, how Applewhite altered his perception, and ultimately the path that Heaven's Gate leads to. And guys, spoiler alert, it's not a good one.
I am black man, saving man's eyes, one stereotype at a time.
To the black mobile. To the corner of Martin Luther King Street and Malcolm X Boulevard. Pronto.
Will black man make it to the crime on time? Or will he be on CPT? Stay tuned at ChrisFraleyPresents.com.
Attention business owners, website owners, event promoters, or anyone looking to promote your product. The Totally Driven Entertainment Radio Network is the perfect way to spread the word of your business around the world. That's right, you can advertise at our network and be played on all of our shows at rates that are so cheap, it's a no-brainer. For more information, contact Bay Ragney at bayragney@gmail.com. to keep your business driven, stay driven with Totally Driven Entertainment.
Are you a fan of Sherlock Holmes? Letters from Holmes offers unique, one-of-a-kind letters from the world-famous detective himself. Handwritten on 8.5-inch by 11-inch aged parchment paper and using smudge-free ink to produce original, high-quality letters that fans will treasure for years to come. Each letter is handcrafted and written from the perspective of Sherlock Holmes, mimicking Holmes's native tongue and embracing many of the famous detective's quirks, quips, insults, and peculiarities. Order a love letter, birthday greeting, personal correspondence, or more only at www.etsy.com/shop/lettersfromholmes.
For $5 today, you can buy a wealth of things. Gas for your car, rent a movie for the family, a few slices of pizza. $5 still takes you a long ways. But did you know that $5 can buy your child a bag of heroin in the streets? That's right. For only $5, your son or daughter can buy some of the cheapest and purest dope in the country. Be aware of the lies. Be aware of the stealing. Be aware that's all it takes to kill your child. $5. This message was brought to you by Casey's Cause, a group of parents located in Southern Chester County out to save your child's life. Come join us today at www.caseyscause.com. And remember, $5 is all it takes. Casey's Cause, www.caseyscause.com.
Looking for that perfect gift for your girlfriend? Then look no further than Teddy Scares. Teddy Scares are available in a variety of styles, sizes, and prices for all your shopping needs. Teddy Scares are a mix of cute and creepy to make a great gift for almost any age. Board up your windows, lock your doors, and log on to TeddyScares.com. And be sure to become our friends at Facebook.com/TeddyScares.
Calling all comic book fans. Do you collect comics? Did you ever collect comics? Do you think your children might like reading comic books? Do you even know they still print real, paper, non-digital comic books? Well, then visit the Pirates of Ontario Street Comics in Philadelphia. We have a massive collection of comic books, action figures, trading cards, and much more. We have one of the largest stocks of back-issue comics in the area. We bag and board every new comic book at no extra charge. Our store is voted the best comic book shop in the 2013 PHL 17 Hot List Contest. Part of the movie Unbreakable is filmed in our store. We are open 7 days a week. Ontario Street Comics is located at 2235 East Ontario Street in the Port Richmond section of Philly. Our phone number is 215-288-7338. Type in the words Ontario Comics Philadelphia to check out our wacky stores page on Facebook.
All right, everybody, welcome back. Hope you enjoyed the commercial break. Sorry about that little cut out there. Hope you guys enjoyed that commercial break. Now that we're back, we were talking about how Applewhite changed his perception and changed his doctrine around for the umpteenth time after the death of Nettles and his slip into depression and his rise, his courageous struggle to rise above it with the help of his loyal and awesome moronic followers. He finally developed the way. He's going to be the first guy to offer the opportunity to reach the kingdom of heaven since Christ. How's he going to do it? Well, Applewhite taught that he was a walk-in, a concept that gained popularity in the New Age music movement during the 1970s. Walk-ins were said to be higher beings who took control of adult bodies to teach humanity. Formed Applewhite's view of resurrection. He believed that his group's souls were to be transported to a spaceship where they would enter other bodies. Applewhite abandoned the metaphor of a butterfly in favor of describing the body as a mere container, a vehicle that souls could enter and exit. This dualism may have been the product of the Christology that Applewhite learned as a young man, or it might just be that Applewhite decided that it was time to change. Nonetheless, the group's teachings had Christian elements that were basically grafted onto a New Age matrix. In a profile of the group for Newsweek, one writer, Kenneth Woodward, compares his dualism to that of ancient Christian Gnosticism, although notes that his theology departs from Gnosticism by privileging the physical world. In the wake of Nettle's death, Applewhite became increasingly paranoid, fearing a conspiracy against his group. One member who had joined in the mid-1980s recalled that Applewhite avoided new converts, worrying that they were infiltrators. He feared a government raid on their home and spoke highly of the Jewish defenders of Masada in ancient Israel, who showed total resistance to the Roman Empire. Increasingly, he began to discuss the apocalypse, comparing the earth to an overgrown garden that was to be recycled or rebooted, and humanity to a failed experiment. In accordance with the garden metaphor, he stated that the earth would be spaded under. Woodward, Newsweek, noted that Applewhite's lean is similar to the cyclical perspective of time found in Buddhism. Applewhite also utilized New Age concepts in his work, but he differed from that movement by predicting the apocalypse, that apocalyptic rather than utopian changes would soon occur on earth. He contended that most humans had been brainwashed by Lucifer himself, but that his followers could break free of this control. He specifically cited sexual urges as the work of Lucifer, and in addition, he stated that there were evil extraterrestrials to whom he referred as Luciferians, who sought to thwart his mission. He argued that many prominent moral teachers and advocates of political correctness were actually Luciferians, and the theme emerged in 1988, possibly in response to the lurid alien abduction stories that were proliferating at the time. How dare they claim to be abducted by aliens? That's my stick. That's it. Those people are evil. Great call by Applewhite there. You gotta keep a hold on your followers somehow. In the 1980s, the group kept a low profile. In the late 80s, few people knew it still existed. And in 1988, they mailed a document that detailed their beliefs to a variety of New Age organizations. The mailing contained information about their history and advised people to read several books, which primarily focused on Christian history and UFOs. With the exception of the 1988 document, Applewhite's group remained inconspicuous until 1992, when they recorded a 12-part video series, which was broadcast via satellite, which, by the way, you guys can see on YouTube. Type in Heaven's Gate. I promise you're going to get a nice little giggle. You'll be sad at the end when you realize that everybody dies, but you'll get over that with the craziness that ensues before that happens. This series echoed many of the teachings of the 1988 update, although it introduced a universal mind of which its hearers could partake. Now, over the course of the group's existence, several hundred people joined and left. In the early 90s, their membership dwindled, numbering to as few as 26. These defections gave Applewhite a sense of urgency. In May of 1993, the group took the name Total Overcomers Anonymous. They then spent $30,000 to publish a full-page advertisement in USA Today that warned of catastrophic judgment to befall the earth. Its publication led about 20 former members to rejoin the group. This, along with a series of public lectures in 1994, caused membership to double from its nadir at the beginning of the decade. So, originally, really small group, but now with these public lectures and this great article that we got published in USA Today, we're going to double up. Now, by this time, Applewhite did not regiment his disciples' lives as strictly as he had and spent less and less time with them. In the early 90s, Applewhite posted some of his teachings on the Internet, but he was stung by the resulting criticism. That year, he first spoke of the possibility of suicide as a way to reach the next level. He explained that everything human had to be forsaken, including the body, before one could ascend. The organization was then renamed Heaven's Gate. And this rejection could have encouraged him to attempt to leave Earth the old-fashioned way, a la suicide. The group increasingly focused on the suppression of sexual desire. Applewhite and seven others opted for surgical castration. They initially had difficulty finding a willing surgeon, but eventually they found one in New Mexico who was all too willing to castrate him. This is one of those next-level things, guys. You got to take it up a notch. Go to church tomorrow, ask people, next time you go to church, just make sure you ask everybody if they're willing to cut their junk off. See how well that goes over for you. In Applewhite's view, sexuality was one of the most powerful forces that bound humans to their bodies and thus hindered their efforts to evolve to the next level. He taught that next level beings had no reproductive organs, but Luciferian beings had genders. I'm telling you right now, I don't know what this guy was all about. You know, this is definitely some next level stuff. But if you're forsaking sexuality, I got to tell you, you are missing out, because that stuff can totally be next level. You put on the slow cut and you get some good things out of that. But that's a discussion for another time. Applewhite struggled with his own internal conflict in regards to sexuality. All jokes aside, Applewhite, it's no surprise that he viewed sexual desire as this very negative force that was hindering not only the progress for his group and the progress for himself, but because of his own internal personal conflict and his own bad experiences with the sexual desire and pursuing your urges, and his inability to reconcile that with his Christian background and his rigid, more rigid Christian background. Not to cherry pick, but it was a pretty rigid upbringing from him being a minister's son and having these desires, which in his view and in the view of his relatives were desires he shouldn't be having. It's not a surprise that these views would spill over into his doctrine, because it's something that he had struggled with his entire life, to reconcile his own personal sexual desires with his faith. Now, he also would go on to cite a verse in the New Testament that said that there would not be marriage in heaven. In addition, he required members to adopt similar clothing and haircuts, probably to reinforce that they were a non-sexual family, but probably just so that everybody would look alike and there would be a sense of equality across the board. This is a common trope within cults. We've got to make sure everybody feels that they're the same, they're equal. Now, in October of 1996, the group would rent a mansion in Rancho, Santa Fe, California. Two video messages in which they offered their viewers a last chance to evacuate Earth. Around the same time, they learned of the approach of the comet Hale-Bopp. Applewhite now believed that Nettles was aboard a spaceship trailing the comet, and that she planned to rendezvous with them. He told his followers that the vessel would transport them to an Empyrean destination and that there was a government conspiracy to suppress word of the craft. In addition, he stated that his deceased followers would be taken by the vessel as well, a belief that resembled the Christian pre-tribulation rapture doctrine. It's not known how he learned of the comet or why he believed that it was accompanied by extraterrestrials or why he should have believed that the dead Nettles would be with them. But what we do know is that he did believe that. In March of 1997, the group isolated themselves and recorded farewell statements. Many members praised Applewhite in their final messages. People who've reviewed these over and over again have said that their remarks are regurgitations of Doe's gospel. Applewhite recorded a video shortly before his death as well, in which he termed the suicides the final exit of the group, and remarked, "We do in all honesty hate this world." Lewis speculates that Applewhite settled on suicide because he had said the group would ascend during his lifetime, and thus appointing a successor to him would be unfeasible. I mean, there wouldn't be a successor because they wouldn't be here. So, winner, winner. I mean, it's going to work out. Now, it's notable that several scholars have talked a lot about this, particularly religious scholars, and one such scholar, Catherine Ressinger, posits that the suicides began on March 22nd. There's a lot of debates on when these suicides started. Some people say it started all at once. Some people say it started over the course of a few days. But based on the evidence we have, we know that it only took a few days before these people were dead. And after these videos, and their bodies were discovered on the 26th of March, so only 4 days after the declared day where suicides had started, according to scholars who were reviewing the matter. So probably not far off there. Now, most members took barbiturates and alcohol and then placed bags over their head. They wore Nike shoes and black uniforms with patches that read Heaven's Gate Away Team. A bag that contained a few dollars and a form of identification was placed beside most bodies. The deaths occurred over a period of around 2 to 3 days. Now, Applewhite was one of the last four to die. Three assistants helped him commit suicide and then killed themselves. An anonymous tip led the sheriff's department to search the mansion, where upon entering, they found 39 bodies there on the 26th of March. It was the largest group suicide involving U.S. citizens since the 1978 mass suicide of 920 Americans in Jonestown, Guyana, a matter we talked about, where not everybody really was willing to commit suicide. Some were, you know, forced into the matter and coerced against their will. But Applewhite's body was found seated on the bed of the mansion's master bedroom. Medical examiners determined that his fears of cancer had been unfounded, but that he had suffered from coronary atherosclerosis. The way of saying that he had heart problems due to plaque buildup, which can cause coronary artery disease, stroke, peripheral artery disease, and kidney problems. So basically, he had heart problems. The death provoked a media circus, and Applewhite's face was featured on the covers of Time and Newsweek on April 7th. His final message was widely broadcast. It's also available on YouTube. Hugh Urban of Ohio State University describes his appearance in the video as wild-eyed and rather alarming. Although many popular commentators, including psychologist Margaret Singer, speculate Applewhite brainwashed his followers, many people have rejected that brainwashing label as an oversimplification that doesn't express the nuances of the process by which the followers were influenced. There are some who speculate that they were willing to follow Applewhite into suicide because they'd become totally dependent upon him, and hence were poorly suited for life in his absence. One scholar, Davis, attributes Applewhite's success suicide to two factors. He isolated them socially and cultivated an attitude of complete religious obedience in them. Applewhite's students had made a long-term commitment to him, and some infer that this is why his interpretations of events appeared coherent to them. Most of the dead had been members for about 20 years, although there were a few recent converts. Others argue that Applewhite effectively controlled his followers by packaging his teachings in familiar terms. Richard Heck from the University of California in Santa Barbara echoes this sentiment, arguing that members of the group killed themselves because they believed the narrative he had constructed, rather than because he psychologically controlled them. In his 2000 study of apocalyptic movements, John R. Hall posits that they were motivated to kill themselves because they saw it as a way to demonstrate that they had conquered the fear of death, and they truly believed that Applewhite was not leading them astray. You can find this. This shows how controversial this entire situation was. And you still get people debating it within the media and the scholastic community. Others write that Applewhite's life displays the intense ambivalence and alienation shared by many individuals lost in late 20th century capitalist society. And this comes from about John R. Hall. He argues about this quite a bit in his book Finding Heaven's Gate: Apocalypse Observed, Religious Movements and Violence in North America, Europe, and Japan. So he covers a number of cults, and you know he's got his own take on this. And then you have Hugh Urban, who wrote with the University of California Press. The Devil at Heaven's Gate, Rethinking the Study of Religion in the Age of Cyberspace. And then furthermore, Winston Davis's Heaven's Gate, A Study of Religious Obedience with the University of California and Nova Religio. So these are some of the guys that are debating this and talking about this. And rightly so, they're kind of close to it. It hits kind of close to home to them. The entire mass suicide takes place in California. So these guys are basically right in the next yard over. It's right there in their neck of the woods. So these guys are writing about this and still arguing about it. Urban from California, from University of California, notes that Applewhite's condemnations of contemporary culture bear similarities to those of Jean Baudrillard at times, particularly their shared nihilist views. Urban posits that Applewhite found no way other than suicide to escape society that surrounded him, and that death offered him a way to escape it. It and its endless circle of seduction and consumption. Media outlets focused predominantly on Applewhite's sexuality when covering the suicides. The New York Post dubbed him as the gay guru. Gay rights activist Troy Perry argued that Applewhite's repression and society's rejection of same-sex relationships led to his suicide. This idea has failed to gain support among many academics. Notably, one of the aforementioned academics, and that would be Benjamin Zeller, who's written about three books on this entire incident. He argues that Applewhite's sexuality was not the primary driving force behind his asceticism, which he believes resulted from a variety of factors, though he does grant sexuality played a role. There are some that say that Applewhite fits the traditional view of a charismatic leader. And one, Evan Thomas, deems him a master manipulator. Lifton compared Applewhite to Shoko Ashara, the founder of Aum Shinrikyu, describing him as equally controlling. And if you're not familiar with Aum Shinrikyu, they're a lovely doomsday cult from Japan, who we are going to talk about at some point. I do promise you guys we will get into them. They are intriguing. They're also referred to as Erafu. So we will talk about that group at a later date. But the comparisons are uncanny. He's being compared to the leader of that cult, Shoko Ashara. Very, very spooky. His paranoia and megalomania gentler yet ever present. And then finally, we look at the aftermath. Applewhite and Nettles were quite similar to many other more obscure and ascetic groups and founding members of schismatic and ascetic groups such as Muggletonianism, which was found by John Reed and Lodewyk Muggleton, a millennialist movement in the 17th century. And if you don't know what Muggletonianism is, it's pretty amazing. They were a small Protestant Christian movement which began around 1651, and it happens when two London tailors announce, these London tailors whose names I already mentioned, John Reed and Lodewyk Muggleton, announced they're the last prophets foretold in the biblical book of Revelation. They grew out of the ranters and in opposition to the Quakers, and their beliefs include a hostility to philosophical reason, a scriptural understanding of how the universe works, and a belief that God appeared directly on earth as Jesus Christ. A consequential belief is that God takes no notice of everyday events on earth and will not generally intervene until it is meant to bring the world to an end. They avoided all forms of worship and preaching. So, I mean, this is another one of those obscure religious groups. And it's actually quite fascinating that this comparison is being drawn, but it's also quite sad that you see some of the comparisons being made. The Shoko Ashara comparison is particularly spooky, and as I said, we are going to talk about Shoko Ashara and the cult, the Doomsday Cult, Aum Shinrikyu. At a later date, but it's truly a chilling story. It's a lot less lighthearted than this one, and I know some people will say, well, this was not really lighthearted. 39 people died. Dallas, show some sensitivity. But the story is just so preposterous and ridiculous by nearly every stretch of the imagination. This is one of those scenarios. The Heaven's Gate cult was one of those odd cases where it's a cult that never really had its shit together in the first place. When we talked about Jim Jones and the Jonestown incident, Jim Jones, he had a pretty clear goal in leading his people. And it was not only his charisma and his tremendous oratory abilities that led him gain such a large following, but it was his rigidity and his ability to kind of hold on to this same doctrine the whole way through. Now, while he may have grafted political and sociological ideas into his religious discussions, and how he does eventually shift away from the concept of religion so much towards utopianism. It's still a lot more of a structured and controlled environment. So I mean, when you look at Heaven's Gate and you look at Jonestown, Heaven's Gate was a cult that was just so scatterbrained because of the leadership and so out there in terms of their beliefs and how they changed throughout the entirety. I mean, they weren't even around very long. They're not even really officially around very long. You know, basically they're around, off and on. They kind of fade away and then come back, fade away and then come back. I mean, they do have some longevity, but it's their inability to sort of keep one doctrine and stick with it. And I think that's partially the fault for that really lays on Marshall Applewhite and his loss of nettles, because as we talked about so far in this episode, Applewhite falls to freaking pieces when Nettles dies. She was the guide, the compass that was leading him. And when she died, he really struggled to explain that to his followers, because he had told them, guys, we're going to move on to another world and we're going to have physical bodies. Now, he does rebound from that, as I mentioned before. He explains to them that, hey, guys, you know, she's reached a higher plane of existence and she's going to get a new body. But ultimately, what's particularly fascinating about Heaven's Gate is the fact that, A, they never really do get their shit together as far as like a set doctrine. They never really keep one. It just changes constantly. But what's particularly fascinating about it is how Marshall Applewhite is able to just, despite the fact that he just changes his mind on a dime about what we believe in now, he's got these people's trust. He's gotten these people to invest their time in him, and now it doesn't matter what he says. They're just going to go with it. Okay, we're changing the rules now. Now it's aliens. Okay, cool. It's aliens. Oh, you're not a problem. You know, you want me to get castrated? Boom, let's do it. That's what's particularly fascinating about this entire scenario, is that despite the fact that there's a lack of organization in this group and there's such a fluctuation in the doctrine that they're practicing, Marshall Applewhite still manages to retain ultimately 39 followers who are willing, 38 other people who are willing to die with him. So he manages to get almost 40 people to kill themselves with him, three of which help him kill himself because he's not really ballsy enough to do it on his own. And then they kill themselves as a show of loyalty and devotion to him after the fact, which, I mean, they could have just killed him and then just left. But no, they wanted to show their undying loyalty and their belief in him, their faith in him. Not only that, but, you know, the fact that these people sat around and were like, yeah, let's just send a goodbye message to my family now, and then I'm going to go off myself in the next room. It really does show you not only the danger of the cult mentality, but it shows you how fragile the human mind really can be, how little it takes really to push people towards the edge. You know, you would say that, you know, not non-intelligent people, we like to think that we would never fall, you know, we would never fall for this crap. You know, I'd never get fooled by a cult leader and get into that. But, you know, it just goes to show, you look at these cults, you look at the scenario with Jonestown, you look at the scenario with Heaven's Gate. Maybe not everybody in there was a genius, but you have to think that some of them were smart enough. I mean, some of the people clearly left, but what drew them in the first place is what's particularly fascinating. These people saw, they craved something different. They got it. But then eventually for those people that survived these cults, the shine wore off, or they were just tremendously fortunate. But the example of Heaven's Gate shows us how not only how fragile the human mind is and how easily people can be manipulated, but it also shows us what to be looking for. Be careful with what you're putting into your mind. Be careful that you are not susceptible to the words of madmen. Because oftentimes the words of madmen sound a lot like wisdom. And the words of wise men sound a lot like madness. Hope you've enjoyed today's show, and I hope you learned a lot. Hope you got a little bit of a chuckle despite the dark subject. You know, I know I've had a little bit of a dark sense of humor today, but I mean, come on. it's aliens. Come on, it's awesome. Do check out the sources that I listed and cited throughout the show today, guys. You're going to want to check those out. And don't forget to tune in for my exclusive interview with Susie Q, Susie Anthony, singer and songwriter out of Florida, in the upcoming segment. Feel free also to tune in to Straight Football Talk Sunday at 9 a.m. Eastern Time, only here with Totally Driven Entertainment. Exclusive interviews, NFL draft recaps and grades, and that's what we've got on the upcoming schedule, guys. Until next time, this has been another segment of the Bareback Facts. I'm your host, Big D, and I'll see you all on Sunday with Straight Football Talk. Enjoy the rest of your week, guys.